I'm fortunately not in a position to, or not that I'm not in a position, fortunately I'm not compelled to teach the class this morning because James Kugel is going to do it for me. Not in person. No, don't get excited. Not so easy. Yeah, I'm going to channel him. If my voice changes, you'll understand that he's speaking through me. I'm using his book, The Ladder of Jacob. So those of you who are interested in the material that we're going to talk about, this is where it's found. But let me first explain what Kugel does, other than make a nice side dish. I can't help it. I just got to. You have to make one Kugel joke. So let me explain what he does. He is he's an expert in Midrash, that is rabbinic interpretation of the Bible, and also ancient Israelite writings that were written at the same time as the rabbinic writings or the biblical writings, but they never found it into any official book. They're not in the Bible, they're not in the Talmud, but they are in fact writings by ancient Jews. It may be an anachronism to call them rabbis. I mean, maybe they didn't have rabbis exactly the same way that we did, but they were ancient learned Jews who wrote about the Bible and the Talmud, but those, they're called the Apocrypha, sometimes the Pseudepigrapha, that is, they're books of ancient Jewish learning that never found their way into the synagogue and never found their way into the study hall, so they're not well known. But what one of the things that they do, of course, is that they preserve traditions and ideas that were floating around at the time that are lost to us, but it shows you, it casts light on the traditions we do have. So what I'm going to do is take you through the story of the Ladder of Jacob, and you'll see it, the fascinating way in which stories about this story evolve and why the rabbis choose this story and not that one. Because a lot of times when a rabbi gets up and says there is a midrash and then tells you what the rabbis say about a story, it seems ridiculously unconnected to what the story is about. And you can't imagine, why did the rabbis decide to tell this story and not that story? But when you see how Kugel develops it, you'll get a sense of the way in which the rabbinic tradition works. Okay.
Yes.
Ancient is the rabbinic period, remember, is 50 BCE to 500 CE, and ancient is most of the apocryphal literature is before that. Some of the other traditions that he quotes are in that period. So this is the first time God appears to Jacob, right? At the ladder we're talking about. Remember, I'll just give you the background for those of you who don't remember the story. Jacob cheated Esau out of the birthright. Or didn't, depending how you look at it. But in one way or another, Jacob fooled Isaac, or didn't, to get the birthright. He got the birthright. There's no argument about that. His mother says to him, I don't want you to stay around, because if you do, your brother's going to kill you, and I can't stand losing you both in one day. That is, I've lost the other one because I helped you, and I'm going to lose you because he's going to kill you. So Jacob runs away. He runs away. He lands in a place called Luz, which is between where he is and where he's headed to. He's headed to Haran, where his family is. And because it's the middle of the night, and obviously there are no hotels, I mean, this is the ancient world, and he doesn't carry a sleeping bag with him. He lies down on the ground, he puts a rock under his head, and he sees angels ascending and descending the ladder, okay? And then God comes to him and says, don't be afraid. Actually, God comes to him before and says, don't be afraid, I'm the God of your ancestors, and I'll take care of you, and I'll bring you home safely. And he gets up and says, there's a God in this place, and I didn't know it. Okay? That's the basic outline of the story. I've left out some details, but we'll come to them. Why, to begin with, had Jacob dreamt of a ladder and angels at all? Couldn't God simply speak to him? And in fact, God does speak to him. In other words, what does the dream add that God can't say? Why can't God say you're being watched over? What were the ladder and the angels intended to communicate? Finally, Jacob's reaction to the dream is puzzling. After he wakes up, the Torah says he took fright and said, how fearsome is this place? The content of the dream is altogether positive and reassuring. What could have frightened Jacob? Okay? So all those questions are questions ancient commentators asked. Why does he need a dream? Why can't God just say, don't worry, you're fine, I'll take care of you? What does the dream add? Why is the dream frightening to him in some way? So here are the here's what Philo has to say. First of all, what's the dream? Jacob caught a glimpse of his own future life in the ladder. He calls it the visionary ladder, because the affairs of human beings are by their very nature comparable to a ladder. A single day can carry the person high and lift some down, can set a person high or bring someone else low, for it's the nature of us, none of us, to remain in the same circumstances. The path of human affairs goes up and down, subjected to unstable and shifting happenstance. In other words, God could say, you're going to have a rough time, but it's not nearly as powerful as seeing the image of a ladder, because life is like a ladder, right? One day you're up, the next day you're down, you never know where you'll be the day after, and in fact, that presages what Jacob's going to go through. So the first Philo's attempt, and remember Philo was an ancient philosopher who lived in Alexandria, Philo's attempt to explain it is, we might say that imagery is more powerful than words. So if I show you an American flag, it says something that words can't say. And how do we know this? Because if words could say it, you wouldn't need an American flag. The whole reason that people have symbols is symbols communicate things that words can't communicate. Otherwise, you don't need symbols, right? It's one thing to sing the national anthem. It's another to sing it looking at the flag. So the latter, Jacob will be able to carry that in a way that he, as we all carry images in our minds, he'll carry that all the way along. And when something terrible happens, he'll be able to think, you know, it's all about the latter. Okay. What's that? I was thinking there's a story about Lincoln, actually, when he was during the Civil War, that he was talking to a freed slave. And when he was talking to a freed slave, the master was being marched by him as part of the captured Confederate troops. That is, the master of that slave. And the slave said something like, "The wheel done turn now." In other words, he was on the bottom and then he was on the top. But anyway, you caught me. So that was the story. Okay. So, right, exactly. It's a good story. So why not? It's a good story. Actually, there's a rabbinic tradition that asks what God's been doing since the world was created. And the answer is God has been making ladders for some to ascend and others to descend. So, what's that?
Roller coasters.
Yes, exactly. Roller coasters weren't invented, but they existed. One hypothesis was that the angels had been sent down to earth. Now, remember here, this addresses the question of why the angels are ascending and descending the ladder. Because if angels are ascending the ladder, that means that they started where?
Here.
So what were the angels doing on earth? That the rabbis also have to explain, right? It would make sense if you said they were descending and then ascending. One hypothesis, that is one theory, is that the angels were sent down to earth to accompany Jacob on the trek from his father's house to that of his uncle, Laban. Why are they here? Because they want to protect protect Jacob. They're Jacob's guardian angels. This theory of having guardian angels, very popular among the rabbis, right? In fact, later on, when Jacob wrestles with the angel, one very widespread rabbinic tradition is that he was wrestling with Esau's guardian angel, okay? If at that point of the journey they ascended to heaven, perhaps it's because they were unable to accompany him the rest of the way. So this starts off a rabbinic tradition here's a good example. If I said to you, there's a rabbinic tradition that the angels of one land aren't allowed to go to another, right? The angels of Israel aren't allowed to go to the United States. The angels of the United States aren't allowed to go to Israel. You'd say, it's kind of interesting, but kind of arbitrary too. But here's the source of the tradition. Because Jacob is about to leave the land of Israel. So why are the angels ascending and descending? Because it's the change of the guard. The angels who accompanied him to that point, to what is now Beit El, can't accompany him to Lavan because he's leaving the land of Israel. So you can understand now how the tradition develops. That's why you have to have a change of, and this is what makes reading Kugel so interesting, is I never knew where the tradition came from that one group of angels isn't allowed to go to another land, although I'd heard the tradition, but now it actually makes sense in a strange sort of way, because it's an explanation for why you have to switch one group of angels to another. Okay, and also, yes, but there's more, there is more. And I violated my own rule. I didn't bring a Tanakh, so I'm going to need to borrow one in just a second. But hold on. First, let me read you this. After Jacob gets married and has spent 20 years away in Machanaim, what happens when he returns to the land of Israel? It's, you don't have to worry about it, but it's 33 chapter 2. It says, oh, no, it's not. 33, That's not the right verse. Let's see, on his return. Oh, here it is. Okay, so. Okay, I can't find it, but if somebody, does someone have a Tanakh?
Yes.
That I can, okay. Let me borrow that for 1 second. No, that's not a Tanakh. This is a Tanakh, thanks. That's okay. 33 I don't need, I need Psalms. Let me read you from Psalm 91, 11 and 12. Okay, for those of you who are interested, it reads as follows. For he will order angels to guard you wherever you go. They will carry you in their hands, lest you hurt your foot on a stone. So that's the source of the idea, thank you, that there are guardian angels that guard you wherever you go, and obviously there's a connection to the stone, right? To the stone that he puts under his foot. Why I can't find the other thing that I was looking for, I don't know, but I'll let it go for the moment and see if I can find it later. Okay. Yes, go ahead. Doesn't say it here. Okay, in your mind they're limitless, but it doesn't say here they're limitless, right?
But why should they be?
Why should they be what?
Limited.
Because they went up and down the ladder.
Why are they?
You're talking theory, but I'm talking story, right? In the story, they go up and down the ladder, so clearly they're limited. If they weren't, they would be everywhere, and you wouldn't have to change them. But he does, so, right? I'm not, right now, I'm just telling you how the tradition developed, right? The tradition is that every person has, you want a psychological answer, but it's not a psychological answer for the rabbis. The rabbis say everybody has a guardian angel. The guardian angel guards you in this land, but doesn't guard you in that land. What you want to derive from that, go right ahead. But that's not, the rabbis are concerned now with the action of angels. And they don't have preconceptions of how angels act and then come to the Bible. They learn from the Bible how angels act. So, yeah.
Rabbi, last week we talked about some of the same rabbis who made a big deal that they were ascending and then descending.
Right.
So if they're descended, then why do they need to not go with
him? The descend are the new angels who are going to go with him. That's why they're ascending and descending. The ones who are already with him, they're done. They can't go to Lavan. They got to go up. The ones who are going to go with him to Lavan, they're now descending. And they're going to accompany him to Lavan. That's
technically
he's still in Israel, but there are some that are there. It's not just that he's technically in Israel; he's not even close to the border. I mean, it's a midrash, so you can make it too. If you get too specific with it, it doesn't work so well, because then he's strictly speaking unguarded between the time he leaves Beit El and the time he gets across the border. But nonetheless, what can I tell you? Another possibility is that the angels were already on earth because they'd been sent down for some previous mission. Anybody think of a previous mission that the angels could have been sent for? Remember, they have to announce the birth of Isaac and destroy Sodom. Right? So maybe these were the angels who did that. Two of the three, remember, there were three, and then two of them were sent to destroy the city of Sodom. But why should they have waited so long before they went back up to heaven? Once, I mean, Sodom is destroyed, they were done with their mission. Why didn't they go right away? So said Rav Levi in the name of Rav Shmuel Bar Nachman, they were ministering angels, but since they revealed the mysteries of God, they were cast out of the heavenly domain for 138 years. What does that mean, they revealed the mysteries of God? We'll come to that in a second. Again, seems like a tradition that doesn't make much sense, but hold on to it. Said Rav Chama ben Chanina, they were cast out because they had been arrogant. And they said, for we are about to destroy this place. That's what they say to Abraham. They don't say God's about to destroy it. They say we are about to destroy it. So they were exiled from heaven for a while until they learned a little humility, and then they were allowed back in. Now, what about the mystery? What about the mystery? Wait, this is what they say to Lot, going back to the story of Lot, okay? They say to Lot, who else do you have here? Sons-in-law, daughter-in-law, anyone else you have in the city, bring them out of this place, for we are about to destroy this place. The outcry made against them to the Lord has become so great that the Lord has sent us to destroy it. Apparently, the angels gave out too much information. All they needed to say to Lot and his family was, get out. Right? So the second tradition is that the angels misbehaved, right? And the truth is that this answers two questions. The rabbis now have answered the question one, why is it that the angels from back then are still hanging around? And the answer is they're being punished. And the second question is, why did they have to give Lot all this information? And the answer is they didn't, which gives angels a certain amount of autonomy, right? That they actually, even though in many traditions, angels are just God's messengers and do whatever they want. Remember that we're in the realm of myth, right? And in the realm of myth, angels also have a certain amount of autonomy, and they get punished, and they do good things and bad things. That's what I just said. I said that in some traditions, angels do exactly what God wants, but we're in the realm of Midrash. And in Midrash and myth, sometimes angels do and sometimes they don't, right? If you look in the book of Job, it's fairly clear that the opposing angel, so to speak, you know, is angry at Job and objects to Job in a way that angels aren't supposed to do it, but he does. Okay, yes. It says, it does say.
Other than right. The words, like right. He's looking on the ladder, do they have wings?
Well, this is a really, you anticipate another, you anticipate another book by Kugel, actually. Kugel wrote another book called A God of Old, in which he talks about the fact that when people see angels, they don't always recognize that they're angels, but when they're revealed as angels, except in a couple of instances, they don't seem to be surprised. And his reading of that was that in the ancient world, people saw angels all the time. And they didn't, and sometimes they looked like human beings, sometimes they looked a little different, but it was not a surprising thing to see an angel. And you didn't always know that you saw an angel, sometimes only in retrospect. It's a really interesting book, but I'm going to leave that for, yeah. The answer is we don't know.
Does Jacob wrestle in his dream with the angel when he's coming back to himself?
No, that's later. That's later. That's at night, but it doesn't say that he was dreaming. But let's hold on to that for the moment. Yeah. Right. So it could be the same ones, you mean? Could they be the same angels? And does it enforce God's sovereignty? It could well be both. The rabbis obviously are assuming they're different angels, but it doesn't have to be that they're different angels. And I want to read on to the verse here, which is 28:12. It says, he had a dream. A stairway was set on the ground, its top was reached to the sky, and angels of God were going up and down on it. And the Lord was standing beside him, and he said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham. Okay? What's not clear is whether the dream and the statement are the same. Genesis 28:12 may say he had a dream, but what follows immediately is not a description of the dream at all, but an account of something else that took place while Jacob was asleep and busy dreaming, right? So the question is, in removing the ladder and the angels from the dream, it eliminates at one deft stroke the most puzzling aspect of the narrative. In other words, maybe it wasn't a dream. What it says is, he dreamed a dream. And then it says, a stairway was reaching from heaven to earth. But maybe a stairway was dreaming from heaven to earth, and in the meantime, while that was happening, Jacob also dreamed a dream. So you can sever the dream from the, and we don't know the content of Jacob's dream, right? All we know is that he slept and he dreamed a dream, and then he got up and was frightened. So maybe what scared him was his dream, but the dream wasn't the ladder. That's possible, yes.
And another thing is the word Behine repeats three times. And you would think that all the Behines would be in one group. So Behine Sulam, Behine the angels, Behine Elohim. So you would think that all of that happened in one context, and the dream was the second context.
Well, Behine, the other... I didn't want to go into this because it's complicated, but vihine actually in rabbinic literature always presages something bad. And the rabbi spent a long time discussing why vihine is or isn't bad here. So, but yes, the repetition of vihine, which means and there is, verbally ties together the three aspects of the dream, but I'm going to leave that aside for the moment. Let's see. So the reason that the rabbis think that the sulam may not be a dream is because in the other cases, when someone has a vision at night, it's God's words and not the image itself that proves to be significant, right? It's not the image that changes things. It's just the words, like with the covenant between the pieces. Okay, I have other, let's see. The changing of the guard midrash, right, which we just talked about, that is, he needs different angels to go in and out, has not really handled the problem successfully. It created an ad hoc rule according to which angels who accompany someone within the land of Israel are not authorized to accompany someone outside, right? We heard that midrash. But by any reckoning, Bethel, or Jerusalem, with which sometimes this place is identified, doesn't sit on the border between the land of Israel and Aram. So it's a problem, the problem that we were just talking about before. If you're going to do the changing of the guard, you should do it at the border. But if you do it in the middle of the land, then the changing of the guard midrash isn't very effective, right? Because whatever angels he changes to are going to have to spend some time in the land of Israel and then cross over. Is that clear?
Yeah.
So instead, why were they changing up and down? Here are two other interesting ideas. One is because the angels all wanted to see Jacob. They wanted to see a righteous man sleeping. So they all went up and down. It was like a sightseeing tour for angels. They wanted to see. But here is an amazing, and this is where Kugel is so, for me, this was as interesting as anything I read, even though it's not religiously interesting, specifically. It says in the Hebrew, V'hine shulam v'roshom ha'geshamayim, v'hine malachei Elohim, right? Angels of God. Olim, go up, v'yordim, and go down, bo. What does bo mean? What does bo, the word bo, mean? No, it's not bet aleph, it's bet vav. Bet aleph means come. It either means on it, but it could mean on him. It could just as easily mean that the angels go up and down on Jacob. Right? They land on Jacob, right? So, he brings a passage from the New Testament. Listen to this from the book of John, chapter 1, which you probably don't remember. Jesus, who's called, by the way, the Son of Man, often in the New Testament, all right? Jesus answered him, because I said to you, I saw you under a fig tree, do you believe? You shall see greater things than these. And he said to him, truly, I say to you, you will see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. So Kugel said, they took the old midrash of Bo, and they transferred it to the New Testament. And you can see, why would angels go up and down the Son of Man? It doesn't make any sense. But it does if you know the Midrashic tradition. So you see how ancient stories get retold in different ways, not just in the Jewish tradition. You can do this with the Quran too, but in the New Testament and also in, okay, so let's go on. Now here's another tradition. But if the angels are going to look at Jacob, okay? Now we're following this thread. The other midrash doesn't work so well, right? It doesn't work so well that it's the changing of the guard. So maybe it's just that they wanted to get a glimpse of him. I mean, everybody knows that if there's a famous person, people will go to take a look. So maybe angels are the same. But it says they're ascending and descending. So does that mean that they took a look at him when they went down and when they went up? That's also a midrash. It is written, Israel, in whom I glorified, I am glorified, right? That's from Isaiah, right? God's saying, I'm glorified through Israel. Now, who is Israel?
Jacob
is the one whose portrait is engraved upon the heavenly throne. The angels thus ascended to see his portrait and descended to see the real Jacob asleep. They had seen Jacob up there, right? Because Isaiah says God's glorified through Jacob. So obviously there's a picture of Jacob up there. And having seen the picture of Jacob up there, they wanted to go down and see the real Jacob down there, just like if you see someone on television and then you find out they're walking on the street, like, you know, you want to look out your window and see the person walking on the street. Yeah.
But it says going up and down. So
right.
They're starting from down.
If, maybe, it depends. They're starting from down now, but since angels have their origin in heaven, they came down for another reason and they're down now, but it depends. So, I mean, different midrashim play it different ways. Some of them want them to start from here, some of them want them to start from there, and they can argue it both ways because the rabbis basically are lawyers. What's that?
What does Vayetse mean?
Vayetse means to go out. Yeah.
Is there ever a midrash that compares Jacob, Israel, to the nation of Israel? And the bow basically is the land of Israel, because when you migrate to Israel, you're Olé, you're Olim.
Right.
When you leave Israel, you're ready. You're coming down from Israel. So he was about to leave Israel. So he's leaving Israel. And basically, the reason the angels...
I haven't heard it, but it's a nice midrash. I like it. If they haven't thought... You know, my father said there used to be a guy, I think I've quoted this before, but it's nice. There used to be a guy at the seminary who used to always say, the rabbi say, and then he would give, he said these really beautiful midrashim. And one day someone came to him and said, you know, I've looked in the literature and I can't find that midrash anywhere. And you say, the rabbi say, where's the midrash? And he says, I'm a rabbi and I say. So, okay. Now, here again is what I find so wonderful about reading this material. There is, remember, I told you what the Targum was, but let me repeat it. The Targum is the Aramaic translation of the Bible. Right. Just as now, when someone sits in synagogue, they have the Hebrew translation. In ancient times, most people didn't speak Hebrew. They spoke Aramaic in Babylonia. And you would have someone called a miturgamon. He was an official translator. The person would read the Torah, and then the miturgamon would say, whatever the translation was, he would say, Jacob had, you know, ladder and so on and so forth. But the Targum was not a literal translation. It was an interpretive translation. It told people what the rabbis thought the Bible meant. So it played some, you know, it would say something like, and the angels of Israel ascended the ladder and the angels of Aram would descend the ladder, that kind of thing. For a word or two, they would include the tradition so the people would know the tradition. Here is one of the Targums. There are several that survive. One of them to this section of the, and you can hear how the translator combined lots of the traditions we've just learned. And he dreamt there was a ladder fixed in the earth, and its top reached the heavens. And the two angels who had gone to Sodom and then been exiled from heaven for having revealed secrets of the master of the world, and had thus been wandering around until Jacob left his father's house, whereupon they lovingly accompanied him to Bethel. Now they ascended to the upper heavens and called out, come and see the faithful Jacob, whose portrait is fixed on the glorious throne, since you've desired to see him. The other holy angels of the Lord went down to see him. That was the translation of the story, and they combined all the different traditions together, right? And so this is how traditions grow and change and get combine, and so much of what we believe is not strictly biblical, but it's a product of this combining and understanding of traditions. So he says, he goes on to say that obviously two different explanations now are combined. Okay, one more. I think there's one more tradition on that. Let me just make sure that that's... Are angels Jewish? Oh, of course. No, I don't know. I'll tell you what I used to say all the time. There are two more things that I want to add. What I used to say all the time was, you know, when Elijah, at Mount Carmel, there's the story of Elijah at Mount Carmel where he sacrifices to God and the priests of Baal sacrifice to God and God won't eat their stuff and takes Elijah's stuff. And then Jezebel, the short cut is Jezebel says, I want to kill Elijah. And Elijah runs off into the wilderness, right? And he says to God, I want to die because the people of Israel don't believe in you the way they should, and only I'm left, and so on. And that's where you have this great scene of the still small voice, where God sends Elijah back. But what happens is Elijah goes out into the wilderness and an angel appears to him. And you know what the angel says to him? Eat something. That's how you know that angels, right? That's how you know angels are Jewish, right? Because that's what they say. Eat something. And we know that Elijah is Jewish because he eats something and he feels better. It's true. It says he eats something and his spirit revived. You can look, it's in the Book of Kings. I didn't make this up. That's right from the Bible.
All Jewish mothers are angels.
Yeah, exactly. All Jewish mothers are angels. If this was a Jackie Mason routine, I would say, had it been a non-Jewish angel, what would he would have said? Drink something. Because Jackie Mason has this whole routine about how after his show, all the Gentiles go out for a drink and all the Jews go out for cake. And then he goes on and he says, and you know they're the Jews because they sit down and they bring a piece of cake. He says, you call this a piece of cake? This looks like a cookie. I want a piece of cake. You know. So anyway. So, all right. Here's the other ascending and descending. It has another possibility, which is that ascending and descending, for angels to ascend and descend, minimum, there have to be two going each way, right? Plural ascend and plural descend. And so numbers start to evoke other numbers. And in fact, in the Jewish tradition, there were four empires successively that would rise and fall. And then the last empire was the Empire of Rome, right? That's the one that the rabbis lived in. And the rabbis believed when Rome fell, the end of the world would come, the Messiah would come. And so the other possibility is that Jacob is foretelling the rise and fall of empires. And that's another thing that the angels represent. So God reassures him and says, God says to Ovadia, though you soar aloft like an eagle, though your nest is set among the stars, from there I will bring you down, says the Lord. He's talking to the last empire, right? So that here is identified with the staircase of history and all the terrible things that are going to happen to Israel in the future. Right, because the whole point of the empires is they're going to persecute Israel, and this is giving Jacob a forefeel of what's going to happen in the future to the Jewish people. Yeah.
Could it be another explanation that Jacob himself is going through transformation and transcending?
So yes.
The angels, all those movements are happening inside his spirit.
If you read modern commentators on this, they internalize visions, right? The rabbis most of the time don't do that. They sometimes do. Most of the time they don't. They see visions as happening external to the person. But modern commentators, especially the more psychologically minded ones, see this as a reflection of Jacob's psyche, right? What's going on inside Jacob is the ladder and the angels. Just as later on when Jacob wrestles with the angel, The Torah, especially there, gives you the opportunity to think that it's going on inside of him. Because it says, Vayivater Yaakov Levado, Jacob was left alone. And then it says, and a man wrestled with him till the coming of dawn. So
maybe these are the stages that Jacob
that Jacob goes through, because you see more change in Jacob than any other character in the Torah. So he hasn't yet gotten to the place where he's Israel, and this is maybe the beginning of his day. And also, if you want to follow this interpretation through, what he says when he gets up indicates that. He gets up and he says, there's a God in this place, and I didn't know it. The fact that he didn't know it suggests either he thought God was very limited, right? God existed in my father's house, but not on the road, or that he didn't know there was a God. I mean, could be either one. Now, obviously, the rabbis don't say that, right? But if you want to follow this line of interpretation, you certainly could. Sure. Okay. Finally, he gives an overview, and he says that all of these interpretations of the dream are intended to serve essentially two purposes. One is to explain why you need a dream, even though God already tells him that you're going to be protected, right? There is no point to the dream. And then the second is, if there is a point to the dream, to explain what it is that the dream does. And one of the things that it does is foretell. First of all, it foretells. That is, it says, it foretells two things: Jacob's life, remember the ups and downs, and it foretells the people Israel, their ups and downs. And the other thing it does is establish Jacob's status, that the angels would come down to earth to see Jacob, that they would go up to heaven to see Jacob. Yeah.
Well, it seems to me that it's really pointing to this place as holy. It's not just that God is appearing there, but this is almost like a portal to the heavens. And so when God promises Jacob this soil, he's promising him the portal to heaven. This is the place where he or presumably his descendants can also have connection to God, and it's a special place. It's not like
it's
any other place.
It's Beit El, right? It's the house of God. And here, you know, you have it's funny because there is this. Both of those are true. That is, there are sacred spaces in the Jewish tradition, but Judaism is a little bit leery of sacred spaces because God is a universal God. So you have, it's inevitable. One of the things that's interesting about archaeological research is when you find a shrine, you almost always find other shrines underneath it. Right? It's very common that sacred places were sacred places because what happens is, you know, the pagan priests worship at this place, and this is where they feel God's presence, and maybe because of its topography, maybe it's higher than another place, right? Because priests also like to look out over people and look down on them. So what happens is then the next religion takes it over, and they wipe out the temple, and they build their own temple on that. They don't just wipe it out and build, you know, a post office. They build their own temple on top of that, and this happens over and over and over again. So I'm sure, even though this will never happen, but I'm sure if you excavated low enough underneath the Temple Mount, you would find pagan shrines under there. I have no doubt about it, that the temple was built it's not just on top of, but to wipe out and contradict the pagan religiosity in that place. Yeah.
I remember the entrance of the rock there.
Yes.
I happened to go to the archaeology center in Florida.
Yeah.
On my way.
Right.
And they said that this was a pagan rock. It was a fertility rock.
You mean the one that's in the Dome of the Rock?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, remember that's the rock on which, at least according to tradition, the Akedah happened as well. So, and we know that around the walls of Jerusalem they dug up altars. So the same thing here, Beit El is probably, although it doesn't say it here, probably a shrine. It may even be that that's why Jacob stopped there, because there are going to be more people in the area of a sacred place and it might feel safer than another place. And now he sees that it's in fact, you know, as you said, a portal. There is a there's a scholar of religion named Iliada, a great scholar of religion, although unfortunately after he died it was also discovered that he was part of the Iron Cross of Romania. In other words, he had an anti-Semitic past that he hid when he came to the United States and became a famous scholar of religions, but nonetheless, he was nonetheless a famous scholar of religions, and the fact that he was a Rasha doesn't wipe out the fact that he wrote some good scholarship. And a Rasha just means a wicked person, like this, like the Passover Seder. And I say that, by the way, just not only because he had that past, but because he never fessed up to it, right? If he really had repented, he would have told people, as opposed to letting them go through his papers after he died. But he has a book whose name escapes me for the moment, which became a famous book in which he talks about sacred space and the function of sacred space in traditions. And it's a beautiful book, and it's a wonderful book. And he talks about how when you enter a sacred space, you feel different. The space feels different. And even if you were to close your eyes, you feel, and he says the same thing is true of your home, that if you closed your eyes, you have the feeling that if somebody magically transported you to your house or to someone else's house, you would know, because the space inside feels different. And I think of this when I enter a sukkah, right? That's a sacred space, or a sanctuary is a sacred space. And so for God to tell Jacob that this is a sacred space, again, should be reassuring, although the flip side of that is that any revelation of great power can also be frightening. And Jacob might be frightened in part because, first of all, he's being foretold that there will be ups and downs, which is scary, right? You know, when you tell a little kid you're going to have a very rough time this year, you know, I tell you, third grade, you're going to have a really rough time. It's not like second grade. You know, every year we say that to our kids. You're going into this grade now. It's not like that grade was. So that could be what frightens Jacob, and that's part of the explanation. Or it could be that what his descendants will go through, you know, that they're going to go through all these different kingdoms. That could be part of the explanation of why he's frightened. But it could also just be the revelation of either... if you want to do it psychologically, it could be the revelation of what he's going to go through or the revelation of what's inside him, right? Which could also be frightening. This is what Goethe said, or Nietzsche. No, Nietzsche said, the German philosopher, he said, know thyself, which is what Socrates, you know, that was Socrates' famous dictum, know thyself. And he said, know myself. If I knew myself, I'd run away. So, and this coming from Nietzsche, who Freud said knew himself better than any human being who ever lived. So, and went mad at the end of his life, by the way. I don't know if that's connected, but that's not very promising. It was probably syphilis and not self-knowledge. So, but nonetheless, just to make you feel better. But what's that?
Knowledge of another.
Yes, knowledge of, exactly. It was knowledge, but it was knowledge of another. It was not knowledge of himself. Yes. Sure.
How is he related to Rome? How are his descendants?
Because he's red, and Edom was the, and he is the follower of Edom. He's the creator of Edom, which also means red, and Edom was the name that the rabbis used for Rome. Why they use the name Edom, I'm not sure, although it shouldn't be too hard to figure out.
Not directly.
Although the rabbis make that connection, but there's nothing in the Torah that says, and there must be some, I don't know what verse they base it on. I'll have to figure out what verse they base it on, but I will look that up. They always connected, though, Esav and Edom. So.
Can you imagine if they knew of the Celts?
Of the Celts? Yes, right. Yeah. I don't know if they were druids or any of the, you know. Look, there were a lot of, you know, I was thinking about this. I was just talking about it to the Lunch and Learn class. When we talk about how... in every generation, you know, people have risen up to destroy the Jewish people. And so you get the inevitable question of why it is that you know, of all the people on earth, why are the Jews targeted for destruction? And I realize that that's not actually true. That lots of people have been targeted for destruction. The difference is they're destroyed. They're gone, right? And that the real question is, how is it that being targeted for destruction, we haven't been destroyed? But most of the nations that, I mean, in fact, virtually every nation that's mentioned in the Bible, they're all gone. And when you said Celts, I was thinking of the Druids that preceded them, you know, or the Vikings that preceded them. And even though they have genetic ancestors, the truth is, as a people, as a culture, they're just gone, which is what's really intriguing. So, and they existed, many of them, in much more recent memory than the Jews. I mean, the Viking raids were in the 8th, 9th, 10th century. So, anyway. Well, yeah.
Since you mentioned Nietzsche, was he anti-Semite or was he not?
Yes and no. Was Nietzsche an anti-Semite or not? Most of his writings were edited after his death by his sister, who was anti-Semitic. In fact, Nietzsche called her an anti-Semitic goose. he didn't like his sister very much. And he broke with Wagner in part because of the violence of Wagner's anti-Semitism. Nietzsche didn't specifically hate Jews. What Nietzsche hated was, he hated Christianity. And part of his hatred of Judaism was the Jewish roots of Christianity. He didn't have a racial antipathy towards Jews. He did not like Judeo-Christian ethics. Nietzsche believed in an ethics of power. And he thought that the ethics of goodness were a sham. That's what he believed. He called it, what he said was that in history there was what he called the slave morality, slave revolt in morality. That is, the Jews came along and they didn't have power. And they didn't know how to take revenge on the people who had power, so they took spiritual revenge. And what they did was they said to the Romans and the Greeks, the powerful and the beautiful were the good. Right? The more powerful you were, Achilles is the great hero. Achilles is the most powerful. And the Jews came along, said Nietzsche, and realized that they didn't have that kind of power. So what did they say? No, you're wrong. The beautiful are the damned. And it's the poor and the oppressed and the despised and the weak. They're the ones that God loves. And he says, and the reason we no longer understand this slave revolt of morality is because it won. Through Christianity, the slave revolt won. So now everybody thinks that to be poor and despised and oppressed is good. And in fact, Nietzsche said it's not good. Only power is good. And what the Jews did was they were actually taking power, but they did it in a surreptitious way, in a sneaky way, because they couldn't take official power, so they got this spiritual power. And Nietzsche hated that, and he wanted to restore the world to real power. Now you can see how Nietzsche was used by the Nazis, right? The Nazis promoted power and thought power was the only good. But Nietzsche would have hated the Nazis because they were culturally Philistines, and he wasn't. And he didn't want to destroy people. He wanted to change people to power. And so in that sense, he hated Jewish culture. But he didn't hate Jews. At least most people think he didn't hate Jews. This is a big subject of debate. But that's at least how it seems to me from what I've read of Nietzsche and the people who write about him, that it isn't that he was anti-Semitic, but he was anti what we might call Jewish values, which is a somewhat different thing. So, anyway.
Was he talking about inner power?
No, he was not talking about inner power. He was talking about power.
Dominance.
Yeah. That the soul goes up to God? The answer is, by the way, I don't want to be too quick. Nietzsche was talking about power, regular power, but he also believed in the individual human being, the Übermensch, who not only had physical power, but had tremendous courage. Thus spoke Zarathustra is where he, in that book, he talks about, you know, somebody who stands on a peak and is greater than other people. Not only greater in intellect, greater in courage, greater in will, all of that stuff. If you want a novelistic explanation of this, just read Crime and Punishment, where Dostoevsky, who didn't read Nietzsche but had many of the same ideas, explores what happens. Dostoevsky comes down on the side of Christianity, though. He shows what happens when people think they have too much power. The answer is, does the belief exist that the soul goes up to God? There's not a belief you can find that doesn't exist in Jewish folk traditions. So yes, the belief exists. I mean, I remember I told you when I was a little kid in the yeshiva, we had a teacher who told us that every night our thumb went up to heavens and wrote down everything good and bad we did that day. It's true. I remember trying to stay up. Honest to God, I'm telling you. But I kept falling asleep, and my thumb was back before I woke up. So, if you say, is that a Jewish, not the thumb, but the soul, is that a Jewish belief? The answer is, just read the stories of Isaac Bashevis Singer. And you will see that every kind of folk belief exists in the Jewish tradition. Every kind of folk belief. So there are migratory souls. Yeah.
There's also the Don Alone prayer.
That God would care for your soul, that you return it in death. But we're asking about in sleep. When you go to sleep, does your soul go back to God?
Next morning, you say I don't.
Right. Who's returned? No, oh, you're talking about the Modani who says Shehechazarta bi nishmati, who's returned my soul to me. Which could either mean that I'm awake again, or could mean that my soul was with you and now you've given it back to me in the morning. Yes, right. So the answer is yes, there are very few things that you can't find somewhere in the Jewish tradition. But especially when it has to do with the operations of God and the soul and invisible realms, because that's where people's imaginations.
Where does the tradition come from that sleep is 1/60th?
It's in the Talmud. It says explicitly, sleep is 1/60th of death. There are a lot of 1/60s, and that comes from Batel B'Shishim. Batel B'Shishim means 1/60th. If 1/60th of milk falls into a meat pot, it doesn't count. If it's more than that, it does. Right? The rabbis had to have a... Which will lead me, I'll close with this for Pesach. Next time we'll also maybe talk a little bit about Pesach in addition to... that's why... You can buy frozen vegetables before Pesach and use them, but you can't buy them after Pesach, right? Here's the explanation. Unless they're kosher for Pesach, right? But if they're not, then you can't, and here's why. On Pesach, there is no batel b'shishim. There's no 1/60. If you drop a crumb of bread into a stew, then it's no good, right? But before Pesach, if there's 1/60th of a bread product in the vegetables, it's canceled out. And it's as if it doesn't exist. So it already doesn't exist before Pesach comes along. And therefore, you can buy it before. Jews are clever people. Or very foolish. So you can buy it before Pesach because there's no bread in it once Pesach comes along. But if you buy it during Pesach, then the 1/60th doesn't get canceled and you're not allowed to eat them. That's if you follow that rule. So it depends how careful you want to be. But if you want to be really careful, then even frozen vegetables you have to buy before.
Does that only work for frozen vegetables or tomato paste?
Right. Some other things. Yeah. It depends. It works for things for which there would be no expectation that there would be any chametz in it to start with. So if there happens to be a tiny, tiny bit, it would get canceled. The thing, usually... The usual rabbinic rule is anything that is processed by machine, you have to buy with a kosher for Passover label, because as you see now when they put wheat, soy, other things, all these things that process, machines that process one thing process others too. So that's why you'll see sometimes this, food is processed in a plant that processes peanuts and so on and so forth. So if it's not processed, like frozen vegetables aren't processed, so that's okay. Tomato paste is processed, so there rabbis say that you should get... last comment and then...
This is a nitpicking question, but like in line 11 it said Jacob gathered stones, but in the morning when he woke
up... Oh, that isn't a nitpicky question. That's a great question on which to end. Right, there's a stone, and there is a nice midrash about that, so I'm glad you mentioned it. The question was, it says that Jacob gathered stones, but then in the morning it says he picked his head up from a stone. So here is I happen to know there's a beautiful Hasidic comment on that, and I can't remember who said it, but here's the comment. It says, why does it start off as stones and end up as a stone? And the answer is that this is how it works in the Jewish community, especially for charitable causes. What happens is everybody starts off as themselves, as a stone. But when they come together for something that's really noble and important, they become one. And it no longer matters which stone. He says, because the Midrash says that the stones fought with each other to figure who would be on top, because everyone wanted the privilege of Jacob's head. But the truth was, once they all came together in one cause to give Jacob a night's sleep or to do a charitable thing, then they were all as one. It's like the Midrash of the Tefillin. You know how the Tefillin has four compartments on the head, but only one on the arm. And the rabbis say that the reason that's so is you can think whatever you want. Everybody can have different thoughts. But when the Jewish community acts, they have to act as one. Okay, thank you very much.